Over the last few weeks, as we have been working our way through the book of Ecclesiastes, as you may have learned by now, it's Solomon's search for a meaning, what makes life meaningful, what gives it value, purpose. And early on, he declared that all is meaningless or futile, striving after the wind, chasing after the wind, depending on the translation you're reading from. And yet, in all of that, there's this bit of bright truth that Solomon keeps inserting throughout the book. He keeps coming back to again and again. In chapter 2, verse 13, he said, "I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness." In chapter 7, verse 11, he says, "Wisdom along with a good inheritance," or an inheritance, "is good and an advantage to those who see the sun." And then in chapter 7, verse 12, he says, "For wisdom is protection, just as money is protection. But the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors." And then in chapter 7, verse 19, he says, "Wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers over a city, or who are in a city." And last week in chapter 9, verse 18, we found him saying that wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. Now what he does in chapter 10 is he looks at this folly that destroys much good, this sin, if you would, that can take away the advantage of the good. And his advice to us, if I could sum the chapter up, is be sensible, live wisely. I want to share with you a number of as I've taken these different verses, grouped them together, and I think these are what he might say to us if you could take them and say, okay, what's he saying in this section? What's he saying in this section? And so on, and try to give you a little bit of wisdom that he is giving us to live by. And the first of those that we find in verses 1 through 3 is that we need to learn to guard ourselves against the foolish impulses that we have in our lives. He begins by using this. We looked at it last week as we ended up chapter 9. It is the statement in verse 1 that dead flies make a perfumer's oil stink, so a little foolishness is weightier than wisdom and honor. What he's telling us, if you could put this in a little different phrasing, is he's setting forth a principle that he kind of ended with in the last chapter, and the principle is this: it takes less to ruin something than it does to create it. In other words, we might say that dead flies are to perfume, what they are to perfume, folly is to the reputation of a wise person. Now let me just give you a little example. It takes less time to destroy something than it does to create it. How many of you who have more than one child can remember a time when one of your children was playing? Maybe they were building something with Legos, building blocks. Maybe she was drawing something out, creating something, gluing it all together. And just about the time they get finished and they step back and they're so proud of it, a sibling comes along and just wipes it out. And it just tears them all to pieces. We used to have that happen with our grandchildren. One would work so hard building a tower, something that they were so proud of, and then their sibling would come along and kick it or knock it with something and just destroy it. And it just took the wind out of their sails, so to speak. It took less time to tear it down than it did for that child to build it up, to create it, did it not? The same is true in our lives. It just takes a little folly. And see, that's the advantage of folly, that folly has or enjoys in our lives. It appeals to that vicious side of us, that side that says, I want to just do something a little reckless. And all it takes sometimes is one reckless moment, a foolish impulse, and suddenly we have set ourselves back a good ways. I'll give you a couple examples in Scripture. One is Esau. Remember his birthright, that which was to go to the oldest son? And on a hunting, after hunting, coming back, his brother Jacob was fixing a bowl of stew, or fixing some stew, and of course Esau is hungry, he's famished, and he comes to his brother and says, give me some of your stew. And he says, sell me your birthright. And Esau did. Something that was to be a possession, something he was to hold on to, something that was to be considered very important, he treated as worthless. And he would wrestle with that decision for the rest of his life. Or, give you another example in Scripture. You remember Meribah? Moses and Aaron and the children of Israel, and they're complaining. Numbers chapter 20, they're complaining because they have no water. And they're wanting to stone Moses and Aaron. And so they go to God in prayer, and God tells them to do what? He tells Moses to go up to the rock, speak to the rock, and from it would flow water for the people. He goes up and basically says, shall we deliver you or give you water from this rock? And then he strikes it. Water comes forth, but what happens? If you read that account, you find that God tells them that because they did not treat him as holy before the people, they, neither one, would enter into the land of promise. A lifetime of leading God's people, and one foolish incident, one reckless moment, and suddenly they lost what was theirs. In verse 2, Solomon tells us that a wise man's heart directs him toward the right, but a foolish man's heart directs him toward the left. You know, that statement is reminiscent of something that we read in the New Testament. Remember Jesus' separation at the judgment of the righteous from the unrighteous? And how does he compare it? If you look at Matthew 25, he kind of brings it out there in verse 32. All the nations, we are told, will be gathered before him, and he will separate them from one another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats, and he will put the sheep on his right, the goats on his left. Well, what Solomon is saying to us here in his example is this. It is that the fool, because he doesn't have wisdom in his heart, he tends to gravitate toward that which is wrong, toward the left, and he gets himself into trouble. The wise man, on the other hand, will tend to gravitate toward the right, toward what is good, and he will focus on things. I'll give you an example. Philippians chapter 4, verse 8. There are things that Paul tells us that we are to let our minds focus upon. Things that are, as he calls them, true and honorable and right, pure, lovely, good repute. He says those are the things, you know, anything worthy of praise. We are to focus on them things. We are to give ourselves to those. Not everybody does that, and the foolish man does not. In verse 3, he comes back and he adds something else. He's telling us that the fool is lacking in sense. He says, even when the fool walks along the road, his sense is lacking, and he demonstrates to everyone that he is a fool. In Proverbs chapter 18, Solomon wrote something there in verse 2. He said there that a fool does not delight in understanding, but only in revealing his own mind. He's going to give you a piece of it. He's going to tell you what he thinks about whatever it may be, rather than trying to stop and listen and learn. Four verses later, Proverbs 18, verse 6, Solomon reveals something else. He reveals that the fool, through his what he says, not only creates trouble for himself, but also endangers others as well. Here's the way Solomon put it. He says, a fool's lips bring strife, and his mouth calls for blows. So in not learning how to control his tongue, restrain from speaking whatever he wants to speak, he ends up creating problems for himself. In the second section, verses 4 through 7, basically what I find Solomon saying here is maintain your composure in situations that just really at times are not fair. And here's the way he puts it. First of all, he says, if the ruler's temper rises against you, do not abandon your position because composure allays great offenses. Now, maintaining your composure, Solomon says, may protect you when someone's temper flares against you. Solomon advised that the wisest course of action when we are confronted with a king or a superior, maybe it's an employer, someone that's over us, when we are confronted with anger from that individual, he said the wisest course of action is not to abandon your position, but maintain your composure. Don't return anger for anger, bitterness for bitterness. Maintain your composure. It's interesting how sometimes if you will just do that, it can oftentimes take the anger down in the other person. I know in times when I've had worked with couples in premarital counseling, one of the things that I've tried to share with them is something I learned years ago, and that is this. Have you ever noticed that when couples get to arguing, before you know it, if you're not careful, it turns into a shouting match? One is trying to outdo the other in volume. They just keep raising the volume. One's going to try to get over the other. And what I would advise is, I said, if your spouse raises their voice, don't raise yours. Keep talking in a normal tone of voice. If they keep shouting, keep talking in a normal tone of voice. Because eventually they're going to realize, I'm the only one shouting. I'm the only one raising my voice. And they might begin to lower the level. But the tendency oftentimes is for us to keep just agitating one another and raising those volumes. Solomon had something to say about this in Proverbs. If you look in Proverbs 16, verse 32, one of the things he said is that he who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who captures a city. The ability to control your anger, the ability to rule your spirit, something that we as Christians should strive for. And in Proverbs 25, verse 15, here's something else he says, by forbearance a ruler may be persuaded, and a soft tongue breaks the bone. Oftentimes you can do more by just controlling your temper, controlling your responses, and being able to forbear whatever is coming at you. But Solomon had also seen something else, and he brings it out here. If you'll notice this, he says, there is an evil I have seen under the sun, like an error which goes forth from a ruler. So these are errors issuing from a ruler, and the problem with this ruler is that this ruler lacks character and courage to do what needs to be done. And so he describes in verses 6 and 7, he describes this ruler for us. Here's what he says, folly is set in many exalted places, while rich men sit in humble places. I have seen slaves riding on horses and princes walking like slaves on the land. What's he saying? That individual who may be a ruler, who lacks character and courage, will put fools, as Solomon say, in high offices and qualified people in low offices. Well, what happens when he does that? He has incompetent people advising him. And because he has incompetent people advising him, he's almost certain to govern the nation unwisely. Or if it's a company or whatever, to run that unwisely. Give you an example. Solomon's own son, Rehoboam. You remember shortly after he became king, and the people of Israel came to him because they wanted him to lighten the load, the burden of taxation that was being put upon them. And instead of following the advice of his father's advisors, older men who were wiser, these counselors, he listened to those closer to his own age who were young and inexperienced. What happened? Well, if you go back and look at the scriptures, you find that he lost, in the early days of his reign, he lost over 80% of his kingdom. 10 tribes split away from him, leaving him only the tribe of Judah and Benjamin, for the most part, half tribe of Manasseh. Another example, Book of Esther, Xerxes, king of Persia. He appoints a man just underneath himself. Who was that man? Haman the Agagite. Or Agagite. You remember what that individual did. He was the one that tried to destroy the Jews, but it ended up backfiring on him, and he ended up being hanged. But had Xerxes continued to listen to him, and had he succeeded, Xerxes would have destroyed his kingdom. So it's important that what we do is we maintain our composure. We make sure that we don't respond in inappropriate ways when things like that happen. Solomon wrote of people's response to these kind of leaders. In Proverbs 28, verse 12, he says, "When the righteous triumph, there's great glory. But when the wicked rise, wise men hide themselves." And then in Proverbs 29, verse 2, "When the righteous increase, the people rejoice. But when a wicked man rules, people groan." You see, it affects those down under him. It affects those that he rules over. Verses 8 through 11, another principle he sets out for us. And this is something that we learn sometimes just by trial and error in life as we're growing up. But it's the idea of making proper preparation for things and not getting in a hurry. Look at what he brings out here. In verses 8 and 9, what Solomon does is he strings together four proverbs that set forth potential dangers that are inherent in daily task. He speaks about digging a pit, tearing down a wall, quarrying stones, and splitting logs. Here's what he says. "He who digs a pit may fall into it. A serpent may bite him who breaks through a wall. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them, and he who splits logs may be endangered by them." Now, there are two ways to understand this, two ways it's been interpreted. One is that what Solomon is saying, he's advising us to use some forethought in our lives in preparation. Because there are risks that are always involved with any activity, especially those activities which involve strenuous physical exercise or exertion in our lives. And how many of us have known a person, and maybe we have been described as that. I was as a child. My dad used to say I was an accident waiting for a place to happen. And we're accident prone. Why is that typically the case? It's not because we're just unlucky. Oftentimes it's because we get in too big of a hurry and we don't listen to somebody who's telling us to take a little more time, think it through, prepare more wisely for it. I'll give you an example from my own life. I grew up as a kid. I was the one who always got the job of busting the firewood. My brother was younger than me, so I was the one. And in my day, I wasn't strong enough to use an axe, but I didn't have the skill to twist the axe without it slipping out of my hand. But I knew how to use a wedge and a sledgehammer. And I would bust the wood. And we were cutting down a tree behind the barn at my granddad's house. And there was a piece of it that Dad had cut up, and many of you who have done this understand what I'm talking about. It's where you have the trunk splits off. You've got two major parts of the trunk going up, and I was trying to split that. Well, that's tricky, especially when it's green. And I had put my wedge in it, and I would drive it, and I'd get it started, and I'd rear back. I'd hit it, and you'd hear a ping, and it'd fly out. I'd put it in again. I'd get it a little bit deeper, so I thought. I'd rear back. I'd hit it, ping, and fly out. My dad came up to me. He said, "Son, you're not going to be able to bust that one. Just let it go. Set it aside, and we'll work on some of the others." I was going to prove him wrong. I put that wedge in. I reared back and hit it with everything I had, and then, ping, it hit him in the shin. He said, "Son, put it up, we're going to the house." I'm lucky, that's all he said to me. But I had to learn the hard way. Sometimes you have to let some things go and work on something else. And here, what Solomon is saying, is that's one of the ways of looking at what he's saying, that we need to give greater preparation. You know, if we're digging a pit, make sure that you protect yourself, that you don't just suddenly fall into it. Working with a doing something around the wall. And we'll look at another side of that in all of these, is that what Solomon is doing is he is saying at another time, your deeds sometimes come back upon you. Give you some examples. In speaking of digging a pit, Solomon may actually have been thinking of something that his father David had written over in Psalm 7. Because in Psalm 7, if you look down in verses 15 and 16, David there in that psalm is speaking of a man who had engaged in mischief and violence against him, and this individual had not repented of what he had done. And so down in verses 15 and 16, here's what he says. He has dug a pit and hollowed it out and has fallen into the hole which he made. His mischief will return upon his own head, and his violence will descend upon his own pate, or the crown of his head. This was an individual who had intended this for David, and it had come back to bite him, so to speak. Like his father, Solomon also wrote something similar to this over in Proverbs chapter 26. There in verses 26 and 27, he spoke of a man who sought to cover his own hatred and wickedness. And here's the way he describes it. Though his hatred covers itself with guile, his wickedness will be revealed before the assembly. He who digs a pit will fall into it, and he who rolls a stone, it will come back on him. I am old enough to remember the coyote and roadrunner. And no matter how hard the coyote tried to catch that roadrunner, all of the contraptions he could devise always seemed to backfire, and he was the recipient of whatever that was designed to do to the roadrunner. This is the idea here. It comes back to bite you because you're trying to do ill to someone else. If you look in Amos, Amos talks about the serpent biting somebody, chapter 5, verses 18 through 20, but what he's talking about there is actually the judgment of God upon his people. And they call it the day of the Lord. And the people are thinking, day of the Lord's going to be good. Day of the Lord's going to be good. But what Amos is saying is no. It's going to be like you escape from a lion only to meet up with a bear. You go to rest your hand on a wall and the serpent bites you. In other words, it's not going to be good for you. So depending on what Solomon meant when he wrote these, it's either do better at preparing for things that you're going to do. Think it through. Don't get ahead of yourself. Be wise about your approach to it, or don't try to do something to someone because you are angry with them, because it may come back to bite you. Log splitting, here he talks about a man using wisdom. And the way he puts it here, if the axe is dull and he does not sharpen its edge, then he must exert more strength. Any of you that have ever done that, whether it's with a splitting maul or with an axe, you know that if that axe is not sharp or that splitting maul is not sharp, you are going to work that much harder trying to bust that wood, trying to split that. And applying wisdom means that I'm going to sharpen this to make my job a little bit easier. Ever tried to cut with a dull chain on a chainsaw? You'll wear yourself out. It just sits there and it won't cut through like it would if it's sharp. Wisdom has the advantage, Solomon is saying, of giving us success. And then in verse 11, he uses the example of the snake charmer. He says, wisdom has the advantage of giving success. If the serpent bites before being charmed, there is no profit for the charmer. Of course not. He's just been bit. And I didn't know this till I'd studied this, but what the snake picks up on is the actual vibrations in the air. They pick up on the movement of the charmer. And until the snake is in sync with the charmer cannot, you know, he does not succeed in actually charming the snake, so he's got to be careful. And if the serpent bites him before he's being charmed, Solomon says, you've lost your profit and probably lost your life. In verses 12 through 15, I think another thing he's teaching us is this. Be careful with your words. Who was it? Benjamin Franklin said, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Any of us that have been the recipient of harsh words know that's not true. Words can sink down deep into our hearts and our souls, and they can do great damage. I've seen many a person, young person, discouraged because of harsh words used against them. And here's what Solomon says. He begins by saying, and he contrasts, he begins these verses by contrasting, first of all, the words of a wise man with the words of a fool. He says, words from the mouth of a wise man are gracious. They win him favor, while the lips of a fool consume him. Now, let me stop there for just a moment. He tells us there's four characteristics that he gives us about our words. One of the things, especially the words of a fool, he says, the words of a fool are destructive. They're destructive to other people, but they're also destructive to himself. As he says here, they consume him. They are self-destructive. A fool will blurt out whatever is on his mind without stopping to consider who it might hurt, as we have seen earlier. with something Solomon's already saying. And ultimately, what Solomon is saying is that it's the fool that gets hurt the most by what he says. Not only are they unreasonable, there's something else he tells us. Are they destructive? They're unreasonable. The beginning of his talking is folly, and the end of it, he says, is wicked madness. What he says doesn't make sense, and the longer he talks, the crazier what he's saying seems to become, because he doesn't know what he's really saying. So his words are destructive, his words are unreasonable, his words are uncontrolled. He says here, the fool multiplies words. He multiplies words. In Proverbs 10, verse 19, Solomon said there that when there are many words, transgression is unavoidable. But he who restrains his lips is wise. Have you ever heard somebody say sometimes the less that is said, the better? How true that is. The last thing I think he's trying to tell us in the latter part of verse 14 and going into verse 15 is that a fool's words are boastful. He says, after telling us that he multiplies words, he says, no man knows what will happen, and who can tell him what will come after him? The toil of a fool so wearies him that he does not even know how to go to a city. Solomon is telling us that not only does the fool multiply words, but he says he multiplies them in saying, even though he doesn't know what will happen, he doesn't know what will come after him, he speaks of the future as if he knows exactly what is going to happen and as if he has control of what is going to happen, when really he does not. In Proverbs 27, verse 1, Solomon said there, do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth. James said something similar to it, didn't he? Come, you who say today or tomorrow we'll go into such and such a city and spend a year there, buy and sell and get dang. What did he say? You don't know what your life will be on tomorrow. You see, we don't know. And yet, he says the fool talks as if he knows exactly what's going to take place and how it's all going to play out. I often attributed this quote to Abraham Lincoln, but I found out in my research in preparing for this lesson, it actually belongs to Mark Twain, and I'm sure you've heard it at one time or other. He said, it is better to keep your mouth closed and let people think you are a fool than to open it and remove all doubt. A lot of truth there. And Solomon added one more item about this individual, if you'll notice the very end, that makes it obvious that he is ignorant, and that he is ignorant of the obvious. It is that he does not even know how to go to a city. I understand that in that day and time, cities, you had roads and they were marked out. This is the way to this city, this is the way to this city. So for an individual not to know how to get to a city made it obvious that this individual didn't know what they were doing. Have you ever heard somebody say this person doesn't have enough knowledge or enough sense to come in out of the rain? This is similar to what Solomon is saying. The last five verses, verses 16 through 20, I think what Solomon is telling us, he's contrasting, incompetent leadership and competent leadership. I have titled this section, Pray for Competent Leadership. I want you to notice what he says here in the first two verses. He says, woe to you, O land, whose king is a lad and whose princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility and whose princes eat at the appropriate time for strength and not for drunkenness. He's contrasting the sorry state of a nation whose leaders are incompetent and undisciplined. And he's contrasting them with the fortunate state or blessed state of that nation whose leaders are competent and disciplined. In the former state, these leaders are immature. They are indulgent. The child or the king, he tells us, is childish. He is a lad. The leaders that he gathers around him reflect his own immaturity. And they take advantage of his immaturity. They feast in the morning and they're given to drunkenness, as he said in verses 16 and 17. And they use their taxes for their own selfish purposes to build their own authority. You look at the later prophets and you find that time and again they spoke out against leaders in Israel who were doing just that. They were adding house to house. They were taking from the poor. They were mistreating the widows and the orphans, something that God said He would take care of. And yet this is why, because you've got incompetent leadership. But the other side, these leaders are true noblemen. They put the good of their country first. They are temperate. He tells us that they eat at the appropriate time. And their eating, he says, is not for drunkenness. Their eating is for strength. It is so that they may use their authority to actually build the nation, not try to destroy it. And then there's the third proverb, verse 18. Solomon describes these immature leaders as being lazy. He says, because, and if you'll notice what he says, through indolence the rafters sag, and through slackness the house leaks. Men prepare a meal for enjoyment, and wine makes life merry, and money is the answer to everything. You see, he's describing these immature leaders. They enjoy the privileges of their position, and they ignore the responsibilities. They are responsible for the ruin of the state and the loss of its protection. You see, when he's speaking about sagging rafters and leaking roofs, he's talking about the state of the nation of Israel. And in their merrymaking, what these incompetent rulers do is they deplete the funds that would be there to actually care for what they need to do. Verse 19, a feast is made for laughter. The NIV translates it this way, and wine makes life merry, but money is the answer to everything. Or as the New King James says, money answers everything. It means the rulers think that money can meet all their demands. And in spite of this irresponsible leadership, as Solomon ends this chapter, what he does is he warns us against criticizing such inadequate leaders. Because he tells us what might happen, if you'll notice. He says, in your bedchamber, do not curse a king. In your sleeping rooms, do not curse a rich man. For a bird of the heavens will carry the sound of the winged creature and make the matter known. So we must be careful not to curse either a king or a rich man, even in the privacy of our own bedroom, as he says. And the reason is, the report may be get back to them. A little birdie told them. An unknown source may disclose that secret that we thought we'd held so close. Instead, what we should do is what Paul tells us to do, that we're to pray for all kings and all who are in authority. Why? So that we may lead a quiet and peaceful life in all godliness. That's what we are told to do. So as I draw all this together, in chapter 9, what Solomon has told us, two things. Number one, he said death is unavoidable. Number two, he had said to us that life is unpredictable. And in spite of this, what he wants us to know is that life is certainly worth living. But in order to live it to the best and to the fullest, we've got to avoid folly in our lives and seek to live our lives by God's wisdom. As a matter of fact, what Solomon is telling us is that the best way to live our lives, the best thing we can do in our lives, is to trust God, do our work, accept what He sends to us, and enjoy each day of our lives to His glory. Because we can't control anything else to any great extent. So my question to you tonight, it's a couple of questions. Number one is this. Are you willing to trust God with your life? Do you trust God with your life? And I've heard people say, well, God's not concerned about the little things in my life. God's only worried about the big thing. No, God cares about every aspect of your life. He cares about everything in your life. What you consider important, even the little things that sometimes upset you and create stress in your life. God's concerned about those. That's why Jesus would say, do not take thought for tomorrow, because tomorrow has enough issues of its own, but seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all of these things shall be added unto you. But the second thing is, will you follow wherever He leads you? You know, David said, the Lord is my shepherd. And he also, one of the things he said in that shepherd psalm, Psalm 23, he leads me in paths of righteousness for His name's sake. That's where God seeks to lead us. in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Solomon, and I've used this passage over and over again, when he said, trust in the Lord with all your might, with all your heart, lean not upon your own understanding. And then he said, in all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths or make your paths straight. It isn't that he straightens out the path before you. It is that he guides you in the path so that it becomes easier for you to follow, because you're following him. If you're doing these things, if you're trusting God with all of your heart, if you're following him wherever he leads, where he leads, I will follow, we sometimes sing. If you're doing that, then I want you to know you have a dwelling in heaven that's prepared for you. As we've been looking in 1 Peter, there's that inheritance reserved in heaven for you. But if you're not doing that, you're constantly fighting against things in this world that you're not going to win on. Because as Solomon keeps telling us, there are certain things that are inevitable in life, and you cannot control certain things. But God sees the outcome, and God will lead you in the way you need to go. If you're not following him, why not do so? Why not make that the most important thing in your life and choose to do it not tomorrow, not next week, not next year, tonight? If you haven't taken that step to commit your life to him in obedient faith, to let Christ remove your sins from you through his blood, why not tonight? It's God's plea to you. It's his invitation. And we extend it to you. If you need to come, won't you do so as together we stand and sing.